Well, I hope you have a satisfying lunch plan for yourself, because I can guarantee that your mouth is going to be watering pretty soon here. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Food and cooking are always a lot of fun to talk about, and I think today's topic will appeal to just about everyone. We're going to focus in on the cuisine of Mediterranean countries, and we couldn't ask for a better guide than Lynn Gigliotti. Lynn is a graduate of, and now a professor of, culinary arts at the Culinary Institute of America. Along with her colleagues at the Institute, she's the author of a gorgeous new book. Well, it's beautiful. It's called Mediterranean Cooking. And let me see here. Lynn, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Larry. It's a pleasure.
I tell you what, it's really, I'm really been looking forward to having a chance to talk with you. When we talk about Mediterranean cuisine, just let's get that established. What countries and cultures are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about a lot of different cultures.
Yeah.
We're talking about three different continents and numerous countries. I mean, it's Spain, Italy, France, the Middle East, North Africa, Greece, Turkey. It's all over the place. It's great. That's why I love it so much, because it's so diverse.
What are the common threads that run through these cultures?
Well, you know, I think that olive oil is definitely...
Yeah.
That's the fat of choice, although there are other cooking fats used. And, you know, something that we call the Mediterranean Trinity would be wheat, olives, and grapes. So that's a common thread among all of these areas. And you'll see a lot of crossover in the dishes. You know, some countries, you know, an eggplant dish might be called baba ganoush. In other countries, called mutabel. Maybe the seasoning's slightly different. But it's essentially the same thing.
Yeah, and so these all translate into their cuisines.
Yes, yes.
What do we not get right when we interpret Mediterranean cooking through a U.S. lens?
You know, I actually think that the whole term Mediterranean cooking was probably coined by one of us Americans, because really, if you went to any of these countries or any regions in any of these countries and you know, suggested that you love their Mediterranean cooking, they might think you were just a bit daft. Because you know, somebody in the south of France and Provence doesn't necessarily consider their cooking Mediterranean per se. They consider it Provençal. Somebody in Sicily considers their cooking Sicilian. You know, the Turks consider their cooking Turkish, not Mediterranean per se. So, you know, I think that's probably something that was coined by one of us Americans, and just to kind of simplify it, but if you look at it, you know, three continents and numerous countries and, you know, hundreds of regions in those countries, it's just an easy way of describing the food in the Mediterranean basin.
Yeah. And that probably means we're not getting the full benefits, maybe health-wise or otherwise, through the Mediterranean cuisines that we have here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably true. And, you know, one of the things that you have to remember about the Mediterranean diet, it's not just a Mediterranean diet or Mediterranean cuisine, it's a whole lifestyle. You know, people in Cyprus don't drive to the supermarket 2 miles away. People actually get a lot of exercise, spend a lot of time outdoors, and their entire lifestyle is just very healthful. So, you know, we can sort of get into their heads a little bit by cooking the cuisine, but it's just a whole different thing. It's great. You know, I really enjoy it.
I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. Are you a fan of Mediterranean cooking? What's your favorite dishes? What are your favorite dishes? Have you traveled in that part of the world, maybe, and would like Lynn's help in recreating a dish? We can give that a shot, too. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go to my Facebook page. You can post there at the Larry Mueller Show. And we have a link to Lynn's book, Mediterranean Cooking, on the Facebook page. I think it's through Amazon, that link. But there you have it, 1-800-642-1234. And maybe we can talk a little bit more about then how all of these different countries, what did that mean for you in terms of putting together this wonderful and beautifully illustrated book?
Well, it meant an impossible task.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really daunting task. If you really want to get into, you know, some serious history of the Mediterranean, I really want to go to Clifford Wright's Mediterranean Feast, which is like the Bible of Mediterranean cooking. So for me, to do a book like that would be ridiculous and not in my realm of thinking, and it's a wonderful book. So what I did was my interpretation of my ideas, how I like to cook using Mediterranean ingredients. And, you know, some of the recipes are very traditional and some of them are absolutely not traditional. Some of them sort of marry different cultures, but I'm using mostly Mediterranean ingredients and technique. But I did take some license. I absolutely admit it. And it says on the book that I took a lot of different countries and a lot of different ingredients, and I threw them into a pot and I stirred.
and with a wonderful result, by the way. One of your favorites is olive oil. And what do you love about it?
Oh, what don't I love about it? It's like liquid gold. You know, if you look at some of the olive trees in the Mediterranean basin and in California as well, in the United States, it takes them several years to mature to the point where they can actually bear fruit. And then it takes a process of bearing the fruit and then the fruit ripening and then picking the olives and taking it off to the mill and milling it and then putting it in a centrifuge. And you take these black olives and you come out with this beautiful golden liquid. It's like, for me, it's like the nectar of the gods. It's just absolutely wonderful. I love the different flavors of them. Some of them are really grassy and they just hit you in the back of the throat and make you cough. Some of them are really floral and very, very tame, and they just are just very sweet and nice. Some are peppery. They just have so many different personalities. It's just amazing that olive oil can be so diverse. So that's my love is olive oil. I cook everything in olive oil. I have olive oil on my counter at home. If I make eggs in the morning, it's in olive oil. When I cooked in my restaurant, we used olive oil as our primary cooking fat. And actually, we never used clarified butter, so we used olive oil for everything, I guess I'd say. And it's just my go-to product. One of the things that I'm not sure I could live without it.
And it's good for you, too.
It is. It is. It's really good for you. A lot better than butter. Now, don't get me wrong. I love butter, but not the best thing.
Our guest today, Lynn Gigliotti, who is author of Mediterranean Cooking, the culinary. She is a professor of culinary arts at the Culinary Institute of America and the author of Mediterranean Cooking. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Sue in Middleton. Sue, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering if Lynn had a recipe for potato kibbeh.
I don't have one in my book. There was only limited space in the book, but I can tell you where you can get a good one.
Okay.
Look on, Clifford Wright's my go-to guy for Mediterranean recipes. So if you look at a Mediterranean feast, I'm pretty sure he's got a recipe in there for that. Or you can look on his website.
Clifford Wright.
Clifford Wright, he's the Mediterranean guru.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. And you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions or comments. What are some of the great seasonal ingredients right now?
Oh, gosh, right now? Well, I'm obsessed with fava beans, so now it's all about the favas. And I actually realized that I have 4 recipes for fava beans in this book, which is completely out of control. But I love my favas, so that's they're in season right now. A couple of weeks ago, I got a whole case of fresh garbanzo beans, which are kind of hard to come by and extremely labor intensive.
Yeah.
But they were a lot of fun. If you've got a little time and a lot of patience. And asparagus are in season, fresh peas. In my garden right now, I've got Brussels sprouts, so I've got cauliflower, I've got radishes, and spinach. There's a lot of stuff going on in the garden right now. Chard.
Oh, yeah.
Vegetable in the Mediterranean. And the beans are coming up. They're not quite there yet. But I guess it depends on what area of the country you're in and how warm it is.
Well, fava beans, we have one of your recipes up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. It's the minted fava bean soup. It sounds really good.
It's delicious. And if you look at that recipe, the hardest part, and it's really not hard, is preparing the fava beans. It's just a little labor intensive, but if you ever sat around with your grandmother, your mom, and shucked peas in the summer, not much more than that. But if you look at this recipe, it's really simple. It's fava beans, olive oil, shallots or onions if you don't have it, lemon, a little vegetable broth, salt and pepper, maybe a little mint, and that's it. So, what I really tried to do in this book is to simplify these recipes so that anybody could make this.
And I'm telling you, it looks wonderful. And I bet it tastes wonderful, too.
It's delicious.
Barbara in Rhinelander is up next. Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
Hi, Barbara.
I have a question. In cooking bulgur, do you have any secret to getting a satisfactory dish? The bulgur isn't either too dry or too sticky?
Well, the bulgur has already been steamed, okay. So it's almost like. I guess we would say it would be a Middle Eastern semi-convenience food. So really all you have to do to get it to work is soak it. So put it in a flat dish and soak it in some warm water. And you're really just rehydrating it. You're not actually cooking it.
Oh, is that right? How about using, chicken broth or vegetable broth for your liquid?
Sure, you could do that. I would, if you want to serve it warm, you could do that.
And you wouldn't boil it, though. I thought I heard you say, Lynn. You'd just have warm water.
Yeah, well, if you want to do chicken stock, just bring the chicken stock to a boil so you're safe. And then put the bulgur in a flat dish and pour it over the bulgur wheat and let it just kind of hydrate. And then if you have any extra liquid, pour it off through a little strainer.
Okay, so you're suggesting a flat dish rather than putting it in a pot or something.
If you wanted to make it, do you want to make a hot bulgur? Is that what you're thinking about doing?
Either one, either hot or cold.
Uh-huh.
I guess I seem to struggle with different recipes that I see in magazines. Some call for, in fact, the package called for boiling the water and then pouring it over and cooking it on low, covered.
There are different size bulgur wheat, so I guess it depends on what size it is. So if you have the medium, it's fine. Just rehydrating it is fine because
it's
most
fine.
Steamed ahead of time, so it's essentially already cooked.
Okay.
Boiling it does it any favors.
And bulgur is really a wheat, isn't it?
It is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah, it's very good. Yep.
And it's high in protein, and it tastes really good.
There you go. Thanks, Barb.
Yes, thanks a lot.
Yeah, appreciate the call.
Welcome.
Visiting today with Lynn Gigliotti, who is the author of Mediterranean Cooking. I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments as we move along here. The number 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. Are you a fan of Mediterranean cooking? What's your favorite dish? Or do you have a question about it? Give us a call. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Having some fun talking today with Lynn Gigliotti about her new book on Mediterranean cooking. That's the title. We have a link to it on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. One of the key ingredients in a lot of Mediterranean cooking is the tomato. And tell you what, coming up, we're going to be talking about how to rebuild the perfect tomato. Our guest is Harry Klee, professor of horticulture at the University of Florida, and he's also known as Dr. Tomato. His research is on focusing on how to bring the tomato back to its glory and the ones that you buy in the store so that they don't taste like cardboard and they taste more like the ones that you and I can grow in our own backyard. So that's coming up at 11:45 today. And Lynn, tomatoes do play a role in Mediterranean cooking, don't they?
Oh, they absolutely do, especially after Ferdinand and Isabella sent Christopher Columbus traveling. But if you look at it, it's really interesting. If you look at the cuisine before the Columbian exchange, tomatoes weren't even in the picture. Neither were peppers or potatoes. So you really have to wonder, you know, how it's changed since then. These are staple ingredients in the Mediterranean diet now. And so thank goodness for Chris Columbus.
Well, you know, our earlier caller had mentioned a bulgur weed. And that reminded me of another delicious and heavy grain to use, healthy grains to use, a kamut. Is that the proper way to pronounce it?
Kamut, yes, the camel's tooth. I love it. It's one of my favorite grains. It's pretty amazing. And I don't think 10 years ago, I don't think you could find it here, really, very easily, if you can find it at all. It was actually discovered, apparently, or rediscovered, shall we say, during World War II when somebody discovered it in one of the pharaoh's tombs.
Oh.
So they brought it out, and, you know, archaeologists rediscovered it. They brought it out and decided to take a shot at growing it again, and it grew very well. And so it's actually Koresh wheat. It's marketed under the name kamut, and it's also called the camel's tooth because of its little tooth-like shape. It's a very, very hard wheat. It's really, really high in protein, but it is a little difficult to cook. It's really hard, so sometimes you might want to soak it, but, you know, the results when you're finished are well worth the issues you might have when you're cooking it.
I believe we also have a recipe up on my Facebook page involving it as well from your book. So kind of looking forward to giving that a try, too. What does it taste like? You have
I guess maybe it tastes similar to farro. You know, it's really a nice, it's a nice hearty kind of, it's got a really nice chew to it. It tastes kind of earthy. I really like it. It's kind of hard to describe. You're going to have to try it. It's well worth it. And, you know, one of the things that I've been playing with, it's not Mediterranean, but I have this thing about macaroni and cheese, and I love it, but it's so bad for you. So I've taken the kamut and the farro, and I've made macaroni and cheese out of it without the macaroni, and it's delicious and good for you. So these are two grains that are really versatile besides being traditionally Mediterranean. You can play with them, have a little fun with them.
I know Judith likes to make quinoa and cheddar cheese.
Mmm. I think Judith and I are going to have to get together and cook a little.
I'll tell you what. Well, cheeses, you know, we're kind of known for our cheeses here in Wisconsin. And so we make some great cheddars and a lot of great specialty cheeses here in the state. And I hope there's a place for those specialty cheeses in your recipes.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, we were invited out to Wisconsin about 3 summers ago by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board, and we toured a number of your cheesemakers, and you guys are really putting out some amazing cheese in Wisconsin. Just really, really good. So there's definitely always room for your cheese in these dishes.
Something else called, how is it, verjus?
Verjus.
Yeah, verjus. I know you like to use that, and it isn't common, is not common here.
You can get it online if you can't find it in a specialty store. And it's literally when, you know, at the peak of grape growing season, they sort of need to thin out the grapes a little bit. And what they do is they take those grapes and squeeze it. And verjus literally means, you know, green juice. So it's the green grapes that have been pressed, and the juice is a really good addition or complement to different kinds of vinegars and salads. It's great on fish dishes. It's really good on chicken. It comes in a bottle. It looks like a wine bottle, and you just open it up, and it's delicious.
I have not. I'm definitely going to have to give that a try. I have not tried that.
And you can also get red red verjus, so that's also delicious. But I personally like the green one better.
And that, you mentioned grapes, and that reminded me about grape oil. Do you ever use grape oil in recipes?
Yeah, grapeseed oil. I do like to use grapeseed oil, although, you know, I'm an olive oil freak. But I use grapeseed oil when I want to do an infused oil, and I really want the oil to taste like just like what I'm infusing it with. If I wanted to make a basil oil and I just want it to taste just like basil, I would use grapeseed oil. Grapeseed oil has a very, very neutral flavor, so it really doesn't interfere with whatever it is that you're trying to infuse it with. And also sometimes when you make a vinaigrette and you've got a lot of different ingredients in the vinaigrette, maybe you don't want that olive oil flavor in there. I think the grapeseed oil is a really nice complement. So I do use that.
It seems like the same ingredients can really take on pretty much completely different personalities depending on the spices that you use. As when you were talking about the grapeseed oil, it made me think about that. What are some of the spice profiles in Mediterranean cooking?
Oh, gosh. Well, there are a lot of different spice mixes. In the Middle East, you've got Ras el Hanout, which has, you know, depending on where you are, can be a combination of, you know, cumin, cinnamon, coriander, black pepper, corns, cardamom. Sometimes in certain areas they even put ground rose petals and the dried ground Persian limes in it. There is za'atar, which is the wild oregano or thyme, sesame seeds, cumin, coriander. There's a lot of different spice mixes, particularly in the Middle East. And if you're talking about Spain, of course, we really have to talk about Spanish paprika. And I'm having a senior moment here. Pimentón. So there are different kinds of pimentón. There's a hot pimentón. There's smoked. There's sweet. And you know, it depends on what you're making. It can take on completely different flavors. That's something that no Spanish housewife would be caught without.
A good
tone. And if you're talking about Provence, you're talking about lots of really fresh herbs and things that we might not use as readily in the United States, like lavender and savory, and things that maybe need to be used in moderation but have really, you know, wonderful flavors to them. You know, the whole Mediterranean basin was like the spice trade was all over the place there. So spices traveled back and forth and to and fro. So they are abundant. Saffron, one of my very, very favorite spices is cardamom. Cardamom is just so aromatic. You know, it was said that Cleopatra loved cardamom so much that she used to perfume the palace before Mark Antony would come to visit her. and saffron, you know, what saffron's actually been found woven into ancient funeral shrouds and rugs. It's been used as a flavoring agent. It's been used as a dye. It's been used as a natural antidepressant. It's got it all. But it should. It's the most expensive spice in the world.
Yeah, very expensive. We have some callers online. Marty and Myra coming up next here. You can join in, too, by the way. We have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Marty and Palmyra, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering what olive oil brand specific would you recommend? I've heard there's oils that call themselves extra virgin oil and they're not, and et cetera, et cetera. And also, isn't there a really good Spanish olive oil out there? And I'll take my I'll take your answer off the air.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. And actually, Spanish olive oil is, I think, you know, no offense because I'm Italian myself, but the Spanish olive oil is the safest bet. If it is marked extra virgin, you can bet that it is extra virgin. They actually have an olive oil board in Spain that has some very, very strict standards of tasting, and they do chemical analysis on it. And so if it's Spanish olive oil and it's marked extra virgin, absolutely is. Spain is was in the recent past couple of years, the third largest producer of olive oil in the world, and one of their main clients is Italy. So, which is kind of ironic.
Yeah, a little bit ironic. There you have it.
I'm going to start getting phone calls from Italy and be angry at me. Apologies.
Oh, man. Lynn Gigliotti, our guest today, author of Mediterranean Cooking, visiting with her about cooking in the Mediterranean style. Her book is wonderful with great recipes. And what I like, and a good for me, I like to have photos. I love to be able to see. I don't have to see every dish, but I'd like to see samples of dishes. And she's got some wonderful photography. Do you do any of that photography yourself, by the way, Lynn, or did?
Oh, absolutely not. Our photographer, Ben Fink, is the best, most talented photographer on the planet. He's awesome. He photographed every single picture in this book. And I am just, when I saw, I saw the photographs on his computer while we were doing the photo shoots, and, you know, I saw them online, but when I saw the actual book itself, I almost cried. His photographs are so beautiful.
So good.
Yeah, I'm really, really happy. And I agree with you. I love photographs and cookbooks. If I could have done a picture for each of these recipes, I would have.
Oh, it's so many. Every shot is wonderful. I just opened up at random here. Soft shell crabs with grilled scallions and lemon polenta, which sounds
good.
Wonderful. And then I look at the photo and it looks wonderful too.
I know, so good.
Oh, man.
You know, one of the fun things about doing all this photography is that we did it all at my house. So it really was cooking at home.
That's great. And do you when you do a dish, are these all these dishes had you done before, or you had just researched and thought, okay, I'm going to try them out, and you tried them out and they worked?
Most of them I had either done before or I had conceptualized. You know, some of them are actually from the class that I teach at the CIA. So some of the recipes are standards from the class that I teach. Some of them were from my restaurant, my former restaurant in Atlanta. And some of them were kind of, my process of thinking when I was trying to put together a menu would be to draw up lists of ingredients, different grains, different seafoods, different flavoring agents, and then sort of put them all together. So I had a lot of these ideas conceptualized, and I would say that I've made every single recipe in the book, and they're all delicious.
Carl in Madison has a question for you. Hi, Carl.
Howdy. Excuse me. Howdy.
Hi.
I never had saffron, real saffron, until I lived in Spain for years, 69 and 70. And since coming back, I've had saffron, and some of it sort of is saffron, but I think it's too old. And I understand that there may be a couple of substitutes or something that you can use, but what do you do for saffron?
Well, you know, we use a lot of saffron at school, so it really doesn't get stale because we just keep turning it over. I think the best way for you to keep it, if you buy it, is to, if you have one of those sealer bags, is to seal it, you know, and open it up or continue to seal it or to keep it in an airtight container. Maybe occasionally put one of those little humidity things in there with it. But, yeah, it does get stale. But whatever you do, don't get a substitute.
Okay. Do you use Spanish saffron, Iraqi saffron, or because it's really expensive? I've had some Iraqi saffron, which is pretty decent.
Yeah, this, The saffron that we have now, I believe, is Spanish saffron. And, you know, it ranges from anywhere from $50 to $70 an ounce. So you clearly at home do not need an entire ounce of saffron. But sometimes it's hard to get good quality saffron in a, you know, in a supermarket. You have to go to a specialty store, order it online, or get somebody to ship it to you that knows you from overseas.
Carl, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. You know, how you actually prepare the food, obviously, along with the ingredients, makes a huge difference in taste and so forth. What are some of the common ways that Mediterranean chefs cook their food?
Well, the cooking methods, not everywhere. It's hard to generalize because, like I said, there are so many countries.
Yeah.
But fresh flavors, fresh ingredients are absolutely key. So it's just not a lot of fancy, fussy, just stove tending. Pick the best ingredients you can find. Make sure they're super, super fresh. And, you know, follow good, sound cooking techniques. I guess that's such a broad question.
Maybe not a very good question. What do you think people find the most daunting about learning a new cuisine?
The different kinds. I think one of the things that people find daunting is the different kinds of cooking vessels that they think they have to have in order to achieve the result. But you really don't. You know, I bought my Cata Plana. It's like that hinged, hammered copper thing.
Yeah.
For clams, and I bought that in Portugal in the late 80s. But do you have to have a Cata Plana to make clams Cata Plana? Absolutely not. You can use a little pot with a lid on it. You could use two sauté pans, turn one upside down for the lid. Do you have to have a paella pan to make paella? No, you don't. You can make it in a cast iron skillet. That'll make a really nice socarrat, the crust on the bottom. So you don't have to have all the bells and whistles. It's fun, but do you have room in your kitchen to store all that stuff? I don't know. I don't know if I do.
Yeah, I don't. I don't.
Yeah. So, you know, you just sort of have to improvise with the cooking vessels. And I think people think that you have to have just the right equipment. And it's as simple as this. When my students ask me, you know, what kind of juicer I prefer, I take a fork, jam it into the lemon, twist the lemon around, and say, that's my favorite juicer.
I wanted to ask you about the Culinary Institute of America. Tell us a little about that.
Oh, well, it's a great place. We've got I'm at the Hyde Park campus, which is like the mothership of all the CIA campuses. And we are located on the banks of the Hudson River in a beautiful, beautiful building that used to be an old monastery. And we've got about 2,000 students. We've got an AM and a PM session, and it's a busy, busy place. There's always some action. And everybody here is always thinking about or eating or talking about or dreaming about food. So you're really immersed in this food culture, which is really, it's really unusual. It's great. It's great.
And what do you teach personally?
Well, I'm teaching cuisines of Europe and the Mediterranean.
Of course. Why wouldn't you be?
I also teach garmage, and I also teach cuisines of the Americas occasionally. But, you know, my real love is Mediterranean cooking. So thankfully, they let me stay in that class most of the time.
You know, I opened the book again to your book again to just open it up. And I landed on page 98-99. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at the photo of Potatoes Anna. And I want to grab into the picture and pull some of them out and eat them on the spot.
I know. And, you know, that is one of those dishes that I took a little license with. So maybe that's not traditionally Mediterranean, but it certainly is French. And you can make it with olive oil instead of butter. But that is delicious. You know, it's How can you beat that? Potatoes, salt, and pepper, and butter.
And that's it.
That's it.
And it looks
simple than that.
It looks just wonderful. And your book is, you have soups and small bites and grains, legumes, and pastas and vegetables and greens. These are the various areas, poultry and meat, fish and shellfish, breads, pies, tarts, cheeses and yogurt, dips and spreads, and desserts and beverages.
Mm-hmm.
You're covering a lot and in about, almost 300 pages.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing to try to do that. I hope I succeeded in giving everybody a little bit of everything.
Well, I tell you what, this has been a real pleasure, Lynn. I want to thank you so much for being with us today, and I hope you sell a lot of copies of that book.
Oh, thank you, Larry. Thank you so much for having me. It's really been a lot of fun.
Appreciate it very much. Lynn Gigliotti is author of Mediterranean Cooking. You can find out how to order it or find out more about it on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you can find links there, along with three recipes from the book. And we picked three recipes that I have accompanying photos. And so that's pretty cool as well. And you're, I think, going to really enjoy taking a look at Mediterranean Cooking through the eyes of our guest, Lynn Gigliotti. And I think you're going to have some fun listening to our next program, our next topic as well. It's certainly a mouthwatering talk with Lynn. When you think of Mediterranean cooking, as I mentioned earlier, tomatoes are one of the first ingredients that come to mind. But finding a really delicious tomato can feel like almost an impossible quest, especially at certain times of the year. Coming up next, we'll talk with a scientist who's trying to change that. His research is all about bringing tomatoes back to a time when they actually tasted great. And I hope you'll stay tuned, because that's coming up next, right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.